Hello and welcome to another episode of South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Archana, a research analyst at ISAS. In today's episode, Professor C. Rajamohan, the director of ISAS, will be speaking to Ambassador Shivshankar Menon on the changes in South Asian geopolitics due to the ongoing India-China tensions. On this topic, ISAS has recently published a new South Asia discussion paper titled Navigating India-China Rivalry, Perspectives from South Asia. Ambassador Menon is currently a professor at the Ashoka University in New Delhi and is also a distinguished research fellow at ISAS. He served as a national security advisor to the Prime Minister of India from January 2010 to May 2014 and as Foreign Secretary of India from October 2006 to August 2009. A career diplomat, he was Ambassador or High Commissioner of India to Israel, Sri Lanka, China, and Pakistan. Welcome, Professor Rajamohan and Ambassador Menon.
Thank you. Thank you, Archana. And let me join you in welcoming Ambassador Menon for our discussion today about China, rising China, shall we say, and its impact on the geopolitics of South Asia. As Archana mentioned, Ambassador Menon, you had a long diplomatic career with India. You dealt with China quite a bit of your career. You also dealt with all our neighbors in different capacities as you were ambassador in Sri Lanka and Pakistan, as well as in China. Then as Foreign Secretary and National Security Advisor, you had a chance to deal with all of them in different ways over the last many years. So probably there's no one better than you. And now you're outside the government and maybe it gives you a better perspective as well of how things have changed in our region with the rise of China. Of course, China's rise has had an effect on everyone in the world as far as Latin America. So it's no surprise that it has had an effect on South Asia. Mm-hmm. But would you say China is now the most important external power for South Asia and it is the biggest role in shaping our region's politics?
Well, thank you for asking me and thank you for this opportunity. And for all the flattering things you said before. Yes, I would agree with you, actually. China is the most important external player in the geopolitics of South Asia today. And in ways in which she was actually not involved previously. That's for three reasons, I think. One is, of course, with China's rise, she herself is actually much more connected to the outside world and actually has to push out and get involved in the rest of the world. She's actually more dependent on the rest of the world than she has been before. So that's one reason why South Asia as a neighbor, China's periphery, becomes important to China, but also China therefore plays a more active role in South Asia. Secondly, as the focus of world geopolitics shifts to the Asia-Pacific, to the Indo-Pacific, and as the pushback to China's rise from the US comes, you find that all the flashpoints actually are in China's periphery. Suddenly, South Asia is actually beside the main fault line in international geopolitics. During the Cold War, we were a sideshow. The main fault line was in Europe between Soviet Union and US. But now it's all in the Asia Pacific and the South China Sea and so on. And the third reason, I think, is that, frankly, South Asia itself has become much more important. It's not only China that's rising. I mean, South Asia has risen in the last two decades. So that, I think, makes a big difference. So yes, and I think China is probably the most important external factor, but also the nature of the relationship between South Asia, China, and the rest of the world has changed very fundamentally.
The word, I mean, it's also China's economic rise, of course, it's made it the most important trading partner for everyone. Today, their roads, railway networks, everything beginning to penetrate. Yeah, across the Himalayas into South Asia. And then it's also becoming a major military supplier. So these two are new trends, right?
Well, it's always been a major military supplier. And I'm keeping aside Pakistan, which is a traditional relationship. In Sri Lanka, during Sri Lanka's 26-year civil war, for instance, China was a major supplier. The weapons that were used in the Nepalese civil war, most of them were Chinese, frankly. Now, how they got there, all that is a different question. Indian insurgents have used Chinese weapons you know, Burma has been an arms market for a long time. So I take for granted. Economically, yes, China today is in a position to do things that she didn't. But I think the biggest shift is the Chinese willingness to actually be involved directly or indirectly in the internal politics of South Asian countries. That is a new development. The Chinese role in encouraging the unity of the Nepalese communist parties, for instance, the clear expressions of preference in Sri Lankan elections for one candidate over the other, that sort of involvement is new. That's a very relatively very recent phenomenon. China's willingness to be a mediator and broker of a peace process in Myanmar between the government and the various separatist movements and armed insurgents. That I think is a new China's offer to mediate on the Rohingya issue, for instance. So interstate disputes, but also internal politics of South Asian countries. So for me, that's a much more active role. The military part, I think, is a logical step from military sales. If you look at China's presence in ports, Hambantota, Colombo Port, Gwadar, Kyokpu, you know, this I think is a natural extension from where China was before.
So how do you see the different countries? I mean, we'll come to individual countries, you know, briefly, but in terms of the larger, because China's ability to intervene in the internal affairs, be an alternative supplier of, you know, investment, trade. In the past, they kind of tried to escape India by turning to the West or trying to use other connections or sometimes to Russia. But today, they all turn to China. So is that produces, what kind of effects does it produce in the region?
You know, it's an interesting question. Actually, you're quite right. It's not only push. It's not only China going out, but there's also pull from South Asian countries. And there always has been. Frankly, if because of India's overwhelming predominance in size, in the economy, geographic centrality, they can connect with each other only through India, etc. I think South Asian country states, which after all might be old nations, but are new states, relatively speaking, have always looked for external balances. So they looked to whoever the dominant power in the larger Asian region was. And if it was the US, they looked to the US previously. Today, China is the rising power, is the regional power. So they turned to China. So I think that dynamic will continue. And especially for, as I said, new states. I mean, old nations, but relatively new states who are in the process of state building, of building identities, they find it useful. And the closer and more like India a state is, the more likely it is to seek external balancing. I mean, it's a paradox, actually. You look at Nepal. Nepal needs an external balancer because, I mean, the ones who frankly, because the real risk there is that their identity gets subsumed in a larger South Asian identity. So there is that dynamic of pulling China in, I think, is there. But that doesn't mean it's not a balancing or a hedging relationship. It's not. And I think the mistake people make is to often think that it's an either or binary choice. That's not what the South Asian countries want at all. And you see this in their behavior. They're very happy to do what India did between the superpowers in the 50s, which is to work with both and to get what they can out of it while building themselves up. And I think we should expect that dynamic. I don't think we should be surprised when we see this going on.
So teaching us the tricks of non-alignment and strategic autonomy. So, but in terms of Pakistan as a special case, Pakistan is always, I mean, I think balanced it, and you know, it was very intensive from both sides. But Pakistan also had the advantage of a strong relationship with the US. So now, as the US-China conflict grows, I mean, does Pakistan, you think, really comfortable with a total dependence on China? In the past, it could diversify to the West. So it had more options, but does it shrinking its options make it worse for them or better for them?
Well, I think Pakistan from a Pakistani point of view, I think walking on three legs is the best. You know, there's a Middle Eastern leg, either Saudi, Iran, Turkey, and the US, and also China. But I suppose once the US withdraws from Afghanistan, which now President Trump says he'll do by Christmas, America's need for Pakistan will diminish considerably. And we've seen in the past that when that happens, the US frankly has other things to do than worry about supporting Pakistan. So I'm not sure whether Pakistan can avoid relying much more heavily on China. She's clearly trying to develop her relationship with Turkey. She's working on the relationship with Saudi Arabia, which seems to have its ups and downs. Iran, again, is a complicated relationship for her. And Middle Eastern politics, in which Pakistan has in the past been very involved, are not easy to navigate. Unless you choose, like India has consistently, to say, I'll work with all the regional powers, but I will not get involved in your internal politics or in your fights among yourselves. But that's not a stance that Pakistan, as a fellow member of the Ummah, the OIC, etc., can adopt or has adopted in the past. In fact, she's done much more than actually, she's actually intervened. Her soldiers have been part of politics in these countries. So I think she looked to hedge, but I'm not sure that she has very many choices in today's world. But her utility to China has grown tremendously. I mean, she has more leverage than I think she's often credited with. As China reaches out, and after all, don't forget, China's making two transitions which she has never made in history. I mean, this is also uncharted territory for China. She's trying to become a maritime power. And this is where Gwadar and the CPEC become very important to China. And she's never been a maritime power before. I mean, one swallow doesn't make a summer. One Trungha doesn't make a maritime power. So there is, for Pakistan's utility, therefore, has gone up. As long as Xinjiang is unsettled or is regarded as a serious problem in Beijing, Pakistan's utility also goes up. So Pakistan is not just India-related utility to China, as maybe she was at certain stages in the past, but she has other things to offer as well. Question is, how much is China willing to pay for that? I mean, the CPEC is a huge commitment. $62 billion is not a small amount to pay for larger strategic goals. But I think right now, I don't think there's any going back from that. So that relationship, that heightened Chinese commitment to Pakistan and therefore to POK, to supporting Pakistan's occupation of Indian territory, et cetera, that I think is likely to continue for the time being.
No, you see CPEC being extended to Afghanistan now, because Afghanistan was really, you know, supported by the US and the West. And if they pull out, what choice do they have? But China. Well,
for the Chinese, Afghanistan, or at least a stable and relatively peaceful Afghanistan, and a friendly regime in Afghanistan, which helps to allay their own security concerns, especially given Xinjiang and so on. I think that is very important to the Chinese, and they will be willing to invest in it. Whether it makes sense as an economic proposition is another question. In fact, I'm not so sure. But as I said, these are strategic investments. These are not investments to make money or on economic grounds. The accountants will never approve of them, but that's not the calculus, I think, here. And China's stake, and I actually think that a US withdrawal will help to concentrate everyone's minds. Yeah. Everyone around Afghanistan will realize that they need to. They've all actually outsourced the job of pacifying Afghanistan to the US for the last 20 years. But I think now everybody, the regional powers, will have to sit up and actually do something about it.
The US was a gift horse, so you're not willing to look in its mouth. Now we'll have to really deal with the consequences. You talked about, you know, Nepal and Bhutan as the Himalayan belt, where China is the closest physically. Historically, they had left it to the Indian, you know, primacy. They did not interfere too much. But today, given they claim for an equal role in South Asia, they don't see as an exclusive sphere of influence for India. So you already see that growing. And our response to that, I mean, you tried when you were foreign secretary, you revised the treaty with Bhutan. We've not been able to do it with Nepal. So in terms of the structure that we had inherited of an Indian primacy from the British Raj, we took it over. But today, a rise of a new powerful force across the Himalayas is going to crack it up in any case.
Two parts to that. I'm not sure that we inherited primacy. In fact, what we inherited was a fractured subcontinent. The British broke the subcontinent. And it started in 1906, partition of Bengal, but went on with the separation of Burma in 1936, and then the creation of Pakistan in two wings. And so I don't think what we inherited was really primacy in a united... What we inherited, actually, the geopolitical legacy the British left to us. And once the Royal Navy went away, we lacked the security at sea either. And we had a whole new preoccupation, which we had to worry about, a sea-blind government of India. So I'm not sure that we inherited primacy. I think we worked very hard at it in the early years when we signed the treaties with the Himalayan states. And when we tried, and Mrs. Gandhi also, both Nehru and Mrs. Gandhi were very conscious of trying to consolidate the subcontinent and to keep external influences to a minimum. I think that was clear. But today, it seems to me that, and even at that time, I wouldn't say that China normally left things south of the Himalayas to India. I think one big cause of the 1962 war was probably the mistaken Chinese belief that India was trying to split Tibet from China. And that Tibetan uprisings and guerrilla warfare was actually supported and promoted by India and the US. And I think what has happened, and so there, it was really a period in between the 90s up to about, you could say up to about 2008, 2010, maybe 2012 even, when China was willing to be relatively neutral in India-Pakistan, when Jiang Zemin would tell their parliament, you should do with India what we are doing, etc. And when China was willing to advise the Nepalese and others that, look, you make your peace with the Indians and you deal with this. This is your business. But since 2012, that's no longer so. And one of the big reasons for that is, I think, China's sensitivity on Tibet. I think their concerns, especially in Nepal, therefore, has become very important. Secondly, I think Nepalese politics themselves have brought the Chinese in. You know, the role of the Communist Party, the Maoists, and the UML, and the unity between them, that has brought them in. Thirdly, it also seems to me that the Chinese view of India has changed fundamentally. And you've seen what's happened to India-China relations in the last few years. They have become more adversarial, much more competitive. I've heard Chinese scholars say that as they see the external environment deteriorate with the US pushing back against China's rise and so on, that they seem to have come to the conclusion that India has thrown in her lot with the US. In fact, I've heard Chinese scholars say India is no longer non-aligned. In which case, then, from a Chinese point of view, it becomes competitive in the subcontinent itself, certainly in the Himalayan belt. And I think we've seen signs of that, whether it was Doklam or whether it's what China has been doing in Nepal, for instance. I think we've seen signs of that. I think from a Nepalese point of view, you would encourage healthy competition. You would encourage both countries to invest in your development and to actually support your purposes. But you don't want it to cross beyond a point. I don't think either India or China also want this to get out of control. No. In fact, if you look at what both governments say, they're very careful, actually, in how they speak of the rest of South Asia. But I think we do have a fundamental shift in the power balance, and both are now trying to find a new equilibrium. I mean, balance of power is not an automatic mechanism. It's not some invisible hand like Adam Smith in The Economy. It's something that states have to work at, and we have to find an equilibrium, I think, among ourselves, South Asian states, India, China, and other countries who are involved in this.
What about the maritime states? I mean, the two island states that are there. I mean, they were in the past, China seemed a bit remote for them. I mean, unlike the Nepal or Pakistan. But today, they're a big, big player. So how do you see the maritime dynamic has changed?
Well, China's reach has extended. She's now a permanent presence in the Indian Ocean. Roughly since she came in counter-piracy off the Horn of Africa, Gulf of Aden, in 2008. But since then, permanent presence in the Indian Ocean since roughly about 2012. And from 2014, actually, it's been stepped up considerably. So as her reach has extended, and since there are sea lanes here which carry her energy and so on, it's, I think, her interest in the island states has grown, and has grown considerably. And the same dynamic works. I think the island states will use that interest to see what they can use for their own development, for their own purposes. But at the same time, you will notice that what India is doing with these countries has also gone up tremendously. If you look at the last decade or so, a little more than that, in terms of maritime security, especially with Sri Lanka, the Maldives, Seychelles, Mauritius, and so on. And I think in the Bay of Bengal, we've been trying. Bangladesh-Myanmar relations don't help, but it's certainly there is scope for much more there. And so has Indian development work or partnership with these countries gone up tremendously. This, as I said, this is part of the new equilibrium. We'll have to work much harder if we are to safeguard our own interests and the common interests that we actually have in keeping this entire region peaceful. But I am relatively hopeful for the Indian Ocean. You know, the Indian Ocean, I think, given its open geography, has not been a battle space like the South China Sea, East China Sea. In history, it's been a relatively open ocean of peace, of trade. And I think that's what it really is even now, despite the bases that we see around us.
The last few minutes, maybe we can look at India's options, our relationship with China is deteriorating, US-China relationship has worsened. China is a, you know, much more powerful entity it is today than it has ever been in the modern times. So what do we do? I mean, clearly it's not only working hard, but you have to modernize the framework in which we have engaged the region. Now, when you were in the government, I mean, you revised the treaty with Bhutan. I mean, I mentioned Nepal, we've not been able to do it. You also, I mean, this is one of the things which is, you never talked about it since you retired. No, the kind of agreements that you signed on security and development treaties, I think there was one with Afghanistan, there was one with Bangladesh, there's one with Maldives. I don't think you got to doing it with Sri Lanka, but there were these three. So it seemed to provide a new template. What happened?
We had a very good understanding with Sri Lanka, I think. We worked well in practice. And even with Nepal, we were ready to revise the treaty. In fact, we'd said often that we were ready to start on an absolutely blank slate if they wanted. I think the hesitations were on the Nepalese side because they weren't quite sure how far they saw different. I think parties wanted different levels of, you know, change I think our attempt was to make India a source of prosperity in the region by economically integrating. You know, we lowered tariffs, etc. Secondly, to convince them that we also saw our security as interlinked, that we had no interest in an unstable neighborhood, and that we wanted stability and peace in our neighborhood because that enabled us to develop. So a peaceful periphery was a common interest. It wasn't just, you know. Thirdly, I think to make it clear that we were not here demanding some exclusive privileges for ourselves, and that we were not even insisting on reciprocity, even though in practice, frankly, just the sheer overwhelming fact of Indian preponderance more than compensates for any apparent lack of reciprocity in various agreements and so on. And I think that made a difference. But, you know, you cannot, and I think it's true of the subcontinent, it's true of India, most good reform happens by stealth. You know, it's, and so it wasn't as though there was some big doctrine, either a Vajpayee doctrine or a Manmohan Singh doctrine. I think we were lucky that we had three big prime ministers who actually saw things the same way, from Narasimha Rao to Vajpayee to Manmohan Singh. And that's why, as you said, it looks like there was a thought out structure that we were actually working to. Unfortunately, I think the world has changed very fundamentally since then. And I'm not sure that we've actually adjusted fast enough to those changes, because the basic balance of power has shifted. And unless we can adjust to that and change what we are doing, I think that original conception that we had, I think that also will need to be adjusted in various ways. But it's going to take a lot of work.
Two final thoughts. I mean, I think one of our problems in the region has been we are sucked into their domestic politics. I mean, like Chinese come and say, look, we are for non-interference, we are for equal relationship, and we say we have a special relationship, and we are drawn in anything that happens inside, and they're trying to draw you in different factions as well. You see a point at which India will say we are for complete non-interference and say, look, for example, in Sri Lanka.
But nobody's going to ever believe it. As long as every border of yours has cross-border ethnicities, as long as every border is porous, as long as, you know, where not only is it trade, where you ban trade, it becomes smuggling and you criminalize your borders. So for me, you might say, I'm not going to interfere, but nobody will believe it. So you might as well accept the fact and go out and make sure that what you do actually serves both your interests. And you do this every day in India, where you take different interests and you find ways of actually negotiating your way through. Why can't we do it with our neighbors? I think we can. We've done it successfully in the past. I'm sure we will in the future.
The final thing, I mean, I think where our regional economic policy has not been in alignment with the natural geography, that is, how much China becomes force, that, you know, Nepal is still in the southern slopes of Himalayas, the natural geography is to trade with India, is to do more things with India. But our own policies kind of disconnected the natural geography and the imperatives of natural geography and the kind of policies of import substitution, inward orientation. We've tried to change some, but you see that happening slowly but surely in the coming decades.
You know, I think we made good beginnings, whether it was a free trade agreement with Sri Lanka, whether it was, you know, making sure that 97% of what Bangladesh sells to India is duty-free, free trade with Bhutan, with Nepal. I think what's missing now is really the connectivity, the railways, the roads, and the ease of movement between our countries. And that, I think, is partly, of course, this jealous guarding of sovereignty of new states. But it's more than that. I think we have a strategic interest as India in opening this up. And as long as we suspect everybody of being terrorists and we build walls and fences, frankly, I think we are doing ourselves long-term damage in the subcontinent. The way to do it, from my point of view, is to open up the connectivity and then let people do what they do naturally, rather than saying building walls, fences, putting regulators and gates and actually rent-seeking opportunities in place to prevent and making trade into smuggling and criminalizing our borders. This is a real risk because it criminalizes not just ordinary people, it also criminalizes your border guarding forces and so on. So for me, this is actually a security risk, this kind of policy. And I think we need to start opening that up. If we do that, and if we realize the levels of interdependence, then I think we can actually contribute to our own security. We need a much bigger, broader view of this than I think we have been displaying recently.
I think that's a hopeful and optimistic note on which to end. And thank you, Ambassador Menon, for joining us and for this podcast of the South Asia Chat. We look forward to talking to you again. And to all our listeners, please do join us in South Asia Chat. Every week we have a podcast with various scholars, decision makers, and policy makers. Thank you all for joining in.